This is WMUC-FM, College Park. You're hanging out with That Fresh Radio Beast, counterbalance to the Fair and Balanced. And speaking of Fair and Balanced, this is Red Hot Chili Peppers, Throw Away Your Television. Yo, what's going on, College Park? WMUC-FM, College Park. It's That Fresh Radio Piece. It's Christian right here with James in the studio. That was Red Hot Chili Peppers, Throw Away Your Television. Right now, we got A Sense of Stan going on. And right now, we're going to get into our fresh piece. First thing we got for you is an interview we did with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. He's a hell of a guy. Highly recommend that you go out there and find him, track him down, and get a bit of his political wisdom, because this guy is a seasoned veteran. He's been serving for quite a few administrations. He knows what's going on. He's been in the high levels, and I mean, yeah, like, there's not much more to say, and I think he should speak for himself. So enjoy the rest of this tune we got in here, and in about a minute or so, we're going to go right to the interview. He's going to talk about a lot of good things. He's going to talk about Iraq, a little bit about the tension, the political climate today with Iran, intelligence in general, the media. Me, James, and Steve interviewed him at the Flag Day procession that concluded the Take Back America conference about a week ago, I believe. You may have heard, or, yeah, check out the station, the website, thatfirstradiopeace.com. Last week, we played the Flag Day procession. It had Colonel Enright, it had Ray McGovern, it had Vets for Peace, it had Code Pink, it had a lot of great people saying some really good stuff. I mean, real stuff, you know. This isn't just, like, something you should dismiss. Whatever, I'm not going to go on a rant and try to convert you. Let the facts speak for themselves. Enjoy the rest of this tune. Here we go. This is WMUC-FM, College Park. Alright, so to start things off, could you briefly introduce yourself, who you are, describe what,
Sure. I'm Ray McGovern. I spent 27 years as a CIA analyst, starting with the Soviet Union and then broadening out to other responsibilities. Toward the end of my career, I was briefing the daily publication that CIA prepared for the President, the Vice President, Secretary of State, and his chief advisors. So I have a certain experience with what goes on in the intelligence community. And when we saw the intelligence being played fast and loose with before the war, several colleagues of mine got together and we formed Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Started writing about how phony the evidence was that was being adduced to justify this unjustifiable war.
All right, and so clearly you're expressing dissent over the policies, especially over Iraq. Could you go into briefly a little detail over the cherry picking of the intelligence that I've heard about and that sort of thing?
Sure. The intelligence wasn't there. And they wanted to make war in Iraq. That was clear from the very first day that the George W. Bush administration came in. And the justification really is simply that we are the sole remaining superpower in the world. We have all this weight to throw around, and if we didn't throw this weight around in key areas of the world like the Middle East, well, we'd be remiss in our duty, because that's not what superpowers do, you know. Now, the biggest factoid of the 21st century is the fact that the world is running out of oil. Let me say that one more time. The world is running out of oil. You know, oil is a non-renewable source, folks. We're running out of it as demand peaks, the supply is going down. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you look around, just look around and see how much our civilization is dependent on petroleum and petroleum products. So what we've seen here in Iraq is really could be described as the first of the resource wars of the 21st century, because it has to do with what these folks in the Bush administration felt was necessary to get a hold of the second largest oil deposits in the world, which happened to lie under the sands of Iraq. So that was why we attacked them, to get in a position where we could control the disposition of that oil, to get permanent military bases there. And this business about weapons of mass destruction, this business about putative ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, that was all, well, in the Bronx we would call that male bovine excrement.
And yeah, me and Steve were talking about this earlier. I guess in this world where we can, like, you know, nitpick facts and just basically pick facts to, you know, back up any opinion you have, I guess how would you suggest building like an unbiased source of like media and, you know,
intelligence.
Yeah, exactly, media and intelligence.
Sure.
Well, the biggest change that I've seen in the 43 years I've been here in Washington, I call it a sea change, because that's what it is. And that is that we no longer have in any real sense free media. And that's a very, very important thing. And so how do you get your facts? Well, the good news is we've got the web, we've got the internet. And all you need to do is keep generally plugged into one or two of those sites, like TomPaine.com or TruthOut.com, CommonDreams.org. If you plug in every day, or you can even have them send you an email. TruthOut will do that. Send you an email every day, and it'll have about 12 titles of articles that you won't find in the Post or the Times. Rarely would you find them there. And so you don't have to read them all. All you have to do is click on the ones you want to see. And you don't even have to read those if they turn out. But that's one way of staying plugged in. And if we can't figure out more imaginative ways to use that, so more Americans can get up to snuff on this, you know? So more Americans who usually go home, throw up their feet on the sofa there and watch Fox News for, quote, news, end quote. If we can't figure out a way to do that, then I think all is lost, because information is the oxygen of democracy, and we're slowly choking for lack of oxygen.
I wanted to ask, since you're talking about the media and how vital it is to just to be informed, well informed about the real issues, I feel as if there's a lack of like human interest. Too many people don't feel for the people in Iraq. They don't understand that they've gone through too much. Is there anything other than the media that can be used just to inspire people to action? Like, I'm curious just how you would suggest how to inspire people to action other than just providing information. Like, is there something else that can be done?
That's a really good question. It's not facts that are going to move people to action. It's hearts, okay? How do hearts get touched? Now, hearts get touched this way. I have a granddaughter who was 4 years old when she watched me on television. She went to my daughter. She said, "Mommy, that's Grandpa." And my daughter Kathleen said, "Yeah, that was Grandpa." She said, "Well, that means the other people are real too." Okay, now that's kind of cute on the surface, but think of what that means. Think of what that means, folks. That means if you don't know somebody in the picture, the other people aren't real too. We don't even get the pictures of Iraq. Like in Vietnam, we did. We had unembedded journalists and photographers. We got a pretty good feel for what was going on there, and that's why we could stop it. In Iraq, all the reporters are hiding out in the green zone. It's too dangerous for them to go out anywhere else, and many of them just take what the party line is. And so, in order to get action, you need to have hearts engaged. Sometimes you need to have a degree of personal involvement. And that's the other main thing that's difference between now and Vietnam. In Vietnam, as you'll recall, we had a draft. That's big. That is really big. Because most of the young people on the campuses, they are immediately affected. And it's understandable, I suppose, in one sense, that they don't really stay up with what's going on. It's hard enough to stay up. Why should they make the extra effort if it doesn't affect them? Well, I'll tell you, folks, it looks very much to me like our president is going to order the bombing of Iran, not Iraq, but Iran, before the election. Why? Well, look at his numbers. He's got a temporary respite now. Why? Because Akawi was killed and because they have a constitution or a new cabinet there in Iraq. But that's not going to last very long, folks. There's going to be more violence next week, more violence the next week. It's just like Vietnam. That's what it is. It's Vietnam all over again. And so this business about staying the course, okay? We've been there. We've done that. It was called Vietnam. And after the time when the war was recognized as having been lost, it took 7-8 years before we got our forces out of there. And and 30,000 more killed. So what needs to happen here is people have to step up and say, look, why are we in there to begin with? If it's oil, if it's permanent military bases, well, is that worth the death of 2,500 men and women symbolized by these caskets out here before the White House? Is it worth it or is it not? Now, there are some people who say, as one very well-heeled gentleman in Wisconsin came up to me after a lecture, and he said, now, Mr. McGovern, what's your problem? I really don't understand what your problem is. You don't dispute the fact that we need the oil, do you? I said, no. Half of my lecture was about our having reached peak oil. And he said, well, then what's your problem? He says, 5, 6, 7 GIs killed in a week? I mean, in Vietnam, we had 600. So, you know, you have to admit that it's a very small price to pay for the oil that we need. Well, I said to him, well, suppose one of those GIs killed was your son. And he looked at me and was very clear that the thought had never crossed his mind. He said immediately, well, it wouldn't be my son. And that, my friends, is the problem, because it wouldn't be his son. The kids are coming from the farms, from the mill, from the inner city. They're not coming from well-heeled people who aren't affected in any way by this war. And so, in my view, when we know what the option is that is called staying the course, when we know the name of that option, and the name is Vietnam, it's not a moral position for me to say, well, doesn't look good. There's more violence every month, certainly more this year than last, but let's let those kids from the inner city and from the farms, let's see if they can stay the course for us. You know, it could conceivably work. Let's give them a couple more years. That is immoral. That is unjustifiable. That really stinks. And even though young people aren't being affected much in the college environment, I think that young people do have a conscience. And I think that you all need to do the modicum, what's necessary to inform yourselves, and then figure out what do people of conscience do when you watch this kind of thing happen. Are we to be like that fellow say, well, we need the oil, you know, 5, 6 kids from the inner city every week? Not much of a price to pay for the oil. I don't think you guys think that. I don't think that you agree with that. But that's what it comes down to. So you need to get informed. You need to kind of probe your conscience. And then, you know, kind of figure out what's best for you. And the last thing I'll say is that if we do Iran is not at all like Iraq. Iraq was on its back militarily. We had decimated their forces in 91. We had sanctions that prevented them from renewing their forces. It was like playing Mount St. Ursula in football, you know? It was a piece of cake. Iran is just the opposite. Iran's got the capability, a capability for terrorism worldwide that dwarfs anything Al-Qaeda can put up. They've got a capability to go against shipping in the Gulf. And they've also got the capability of throwing a few divisions over the border in Iraq, where our forces are hunting terrorists, of course, and they're not disposed to be able to handle that. And then besides, there aren't enough of them. And that's the key, folks. There aren't enough of them. And when that balloon goes up, let's say Iran sends a division or two into Iraq, where they're welcomed by the Sunnis, who are pretty much their cousins on the other side of the border, what does the president do then? Well, he's got two choices, it seems. One is to renew the draft, then you would be affected. You would be immediately affected. Or the other one is to nuke the hell out of them. Now, nobody wants a draft renewed, but I think still fewer people would think that nuking anybody is a solution to anything these days. So those are the choices we face unless we can put the reins on this government and make them accountable. And make them see that you know, we do have a conscience, and we're going to speak out and go to our representatives and make sure that they start representing us.
You got another one?
Okay. Let me go try and do it. To a congressional response, well, able government that can control themselves. I found that hard to believe, and I was just wondering how you would respond to that, given that. I think the American public
is almost at a consensus as for oil. So I was just curious as to how you would respond to something like that.
Well, building democracy in Iraq reminds me of what they used to say about Vietnam. That famous lieutenant said, well, we had to level that village to save it, you know, save it for democracy. Democracy is the default explanation for the war in Iraq. You don't have to remember very far back, but it was just three and a half years ago where the administration was saying there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They pose a great danger to Israel and other neighbors, and even to us. And Saddam Hussein is going to use them against us if we don't move against him. Okay? That's what they were saying. They're also saying that Saddam Hussein is going to give some of these nuclear weapons to terrorists, and that he had something to do with Al-Qaeda. That last thing was the most pernicious, the most cynical, the most dishonest observation. Because what they wanted to do was to identify Saddam Hussein with 9/11. And do you know that right before the war, 69% of the American people thought that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, and that lasted several months into the war. And I would dare say that about half of the American people still think that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. It was an incredibly artfully contrived public relations stunt. And, you know, that when they tried to find evidence of that, and they were all over the CIA and the Defense Department and the State Department, find us the evidence. We know that there are ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. They found nothing. Nothing. And the 9/11 Commission, to its credit in this case, established that there were no operative ties. No real ties that meant anything between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And so when the Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, in the midst of all of this, in September of 2002, as they're beating the war drums, he said that the evidence of ties between Saddam Hussein, between Al-Qaeda and the government of Saddam Hussein are bulletproof. That was his word, bulletproof, okay? Now, that was a bald lie, okay? But they needed that to bring the American people around and the Congress around to say, well, if Saddam Hussein was such a bad guy that he had something to do with 9/11, and if he has these weapons of mass destruction, and if he's going to give he's going to get nuclear weapons to terrorists, well, then we better zap him. None of those things were true. And they proved not to be true when the CIA established beyond any doubt there were no ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And when the 9/11 Commission said the same, and then, of course, they couldn't find any weapons of mass destruction. So what were they going to say? Were they going to say, oh, sorry about that, delete all the above? They had to find some other reason. And the other reason they found was they're going to bring democracy to Iraq.
And that was Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, who was speaking on Iraq, Iran, the media, and the intelligence community, the state of it today, and the manipulation that has been shrouding it lately. And now we're going to get into Carlos Mauricio. We were talking about him earlier, torture survivor from El Salvador. During the 80s, he suffered under the death squads that came as a result of both Central American and U.S. policies of the day. If you remember last week, we spoke with Colonel Ann Wright, who was involved with the humanitarian side of the missions involving El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and the whole Iran-Contra scandal. And so now we're going to put the other side of the story on, the darker side, I guess you could say. Here is a man who suffered under that. And remember, this was in front of John Negroponte's house, who earlier we talked about, alleged war criminal, torture policy maker, as we like to call him. And we're not going to bash him any longer, but here is Carlos Mauricio.
Of impunity. And he's also here for the United Nations Day marking, commemorating torture and torture survivors.
Yeah, he said I'm a torture survivor. I was captured by the Salvadoran Army in 1983. I was kidnapped from my classroom in the University of El Salvador in 1983. This squad came from my classroom, and they took me from there. I was badly, badly beaten that day. And it was the day in which Death Squad were doing many, many killings in El Salvador. And as many of you know, in El Salvador, as in Honduras, the Death Squad were organized by a guy named John Negroponte. He did it. He did it. He was the guy who organized all the Death Squads in Honduras. And he agreed, and he knew that Death Squads in Honduras were killing hundreds of civilians. And he knew that. He got information about it. So, we know that he knew about Death Squads in Honduras. And we know that he also knew about Death Squads in El Salvador. I was captured in 1983, and I was kidnapped and brought to a chamber of torture in the National Police Headquarters in El Salvador, and I was badly, badly tortured there. I am a survivor short of a miracle. I came out of the prison after being tortured for 3 weeks every single night. They tortured me 3 weeks every single night because I was a thinker. I was a person who think, and I was a person who questioned the government. And it is so dangerous if you are able to think, if you are able to question. The people in power want you not to say anything, to follow orders. Everything is nice. Everything is okay. We are winning the war in Iraq. Don't you worry. So, after I left prison, badly, badly tortured, I got several broken bones. I got so injuries, many injuries in my body. But I left the prison finally, and I came to the United States. I believe that this story that I am telling today is the same story that happened in Iraq. I was deprived of sleeping. I was badly, badly beaten. I was given no bathroom, no. I was given no bathroom facilities, not food, nor water. I was indeed badly, badly beaten before the real torturer came to the chamber of torture in which I was detained, completely blindfolded. And this is very important to know, because if you have seen pictures of the people being captured in Iraq, the very first thing that USA Army is doing is blindfold them. It's immediately they blindfold, as I was blindfolded. And when I have seen the picture of the Iraqi people captured, it reminds me, because I was also blindfolded. I am the person who kept in that chamber of torture for weeks and weeks. You know, I was unable to see anybody. And they came and gave me electroshocks. I was giving electroshocks. As many other prisoners, I heard women being raped. I heard people being beaten. I heard many people there being also waterboarded. You know, they put in a water container and put their head there until the people also drowned. They put it back again. And then after they knew that they were alive, put them back. And I heard that. I was there. I was handcuffed to a pipe and I was completely blindfolded. What happened after 3 weeks of being blindfolded, you are completely lost. Mm-hmm. You know where you are. Because that is the main role of the blindfold. You are blindfolded, then you lose the sense of time and space because you no longer belong to the environment. And this is the idea. I was blindfolded for 3 weeks in a row. By a miracle, I left the chamber of torture. And then after being in the chamber of torture for 3 weeks, I was brought to a common cell. I was brought to a common cell, taking away the blindfold from me, and then I realized that I was in the National Police Headquarters in San Salvador, and the guy who tortured me were members of the National Police in El Salvador. And you know what happened to me? One day, I was in the common cell. I was there in the common cell, and you know what happened? A guard came and said, "Come out." And I thought that he was going to kill me because they took me underground cells. They took me the clandestine cells in El Salvador. The clandestine cells that now we have also. The clandestine cells that we now also have here in the United States. Disappearances are called extraordinary rendition. And torture is openly doing. The U.S. Army is torturing openly in Iraq. In Guantanamo, people have been tortured, horribly tortured there. Out of a miracle, they took me from the cell and I was taken to the underground cell. I was waiting there to be killed. I was there waiting to be killed. I waited for 4 hours, and they never killed me. However, the guy who took me down there came back again and took me back to the cell. I wonder why he came and took me there and then put me back 4 hours later. You know what happened? What happened is that the committee of the Red Cross International came looking for me, and they took me down there. I was a ghost prisoner, like Abu Ghraib. The same thing. What happened to me? What happened to me is a torture by the book. What happened to me? Every single step is what happened in Abu Ghraib and in Guantanamo. It's the same thing. Torture has been carried out for many, many years. And one of the guys who supervises torture in Honduras, his name is John Negroponte. And we know that he's responsible for torture, disappearances, and kidnapping. We know that. Now I am here in Washington because we are here and commemorating the 26th of June. The United Nations said that 26th of June is to commemorate torture survivors like me. We are many torture survivors by luck, because thousands were killed. Thousands couldn't come and tell you why what happened to me. I am responsible for come and tell you guys my experience, which experience they cannot say because they were killed. It is my responsibility to come and tell what happened to me. Otherwise, it's going to be repeated soon here in the United States. Not in Guantanamo, not in Iraq, but here in the United States. That is the whole situation. And that's what I'm doing here. It's not pretty, it's not nice coming and talking about a horrible experience, but I want to do it. I want to do it because otherwise, torture is going to happen here in the United States. Thank you.
And that was Carlos Mauricio, torture survivor, victim, here because yesterday was the UN's Day of Recognition for torture survivors and victims all over the world. There was a 24-hour vigil, actually, at Lafayette Park in front of the White House, where every hour there was either a survivor telling their experience or a workshop going on or some sort of activity to honor those that have suffered and did not survive through their torture. And so now we have two special guests today, and would you guys like to introduce yourselves?
I'm Reza Safarnishad, and my wife here.
Katrine Kassiri.
And so you guys are here today because we're going to talk about your new book, Veiled Souls. Would you like to, in a nutshell, I guess, describe what it is, what's it about?
Sure. Veiled Souls is my wife's memoir and some of my memoirs growing up in Iran and coming to the United States. In some ways, it's a very typical story of immigrants who come to the United States and live, you know, find freedom and look for freedom and find it. Her story is very extraordinary, although somewhat typical of Iranians, minority religions living in Iran. Katrine comes from a Baha'i family. It's a minority religion, fairly new religion. It's only been around for 150 years. But they're not accepted by Iran's government as a real religion, as an official religion, and therefore they're persecuted. Growing up Baha'i before Iran's revolution, when Iran was under secular government, was a lot easier. You know, that you could live and freely and practice your religion and all that. But once in 1979, when the new government took over and it became a religious theocracy, they made life a living heck for Baha'is in Iran. And therefore, a lot of them left. Not that life was all that much better for everybody else, but I think Baha'is in particular got the harshest ones. Obviously, if you're Jewish, Christian, or anything other than a Shiite Muslim, your life is harder. If you're a Shiite Muslim, you know, you could still do something or say something that would not sit well with the government, and that wouldn't help either. But to say a little about her experiences, like I said, she grew up before Iran's revolution, fairly normal life, and she saw all the stuff that happened after Iran's revolution. Her dad and her family would lose their government jobs because they wouldn't become Muslims, and she wasn't allowed to go to university because she wouldn't say she's a Muslim. And she had to leave Iran illegally because Iran's government doesn't recognize the Baha'i religion, wouldn't give him a passport. And very interesting story. She and her sister had to fly out to a city in the middle of the desert near the Pakistani border in Iran and traveled the rest of the way through camelbacks with human traffickers, stay in Pakistan for about 2 years before coming to the United States.
And, I guess I wanted to just ask you guys a little bit, like, why you wrote this book. Like, what were you trying to, you know, set aside or get the message out about?
The reason that we wrote this book, because it's about religion tolerance, religious tolerance, to give the message to all parents, that to not be prejudiced, because I observed how my sister's death as a child when I was 8 years old, my sister fell in love with a Muslim man, and both family were opposed, and she wanted to scare them, and she committed suicide, and unfortunately we lost her, and that was that experience stayed with me until today, and I always wanted to write this book to let the world know that we have to be less prejudiced about our faith.
What's interesting was all of this happened before the Ayatollah, before Iran's revolution, before. Right. So it's a typical prejudice of family. Her family is very Baha'i. His family, the guy's family, is very religiously Muslim. And it's funny, this young man or woman, her sister at that time was only 17 years old. Right. The guy was, 20 years old or so, very young. Mm-hmm. Completely in love, they wanted to get married, and both families are saying, no, you can't get married outside of your faith, because you're Baha'i and his Muslim, it's not going to work. And she wanted to scare, her sister Nasreen wanted to scare her family, so she said, I'm going to take some pills and scare him, and unfortunately it worked. Mm-hmm. She died as a result. Katrine's mom never recovered from seeing her daughter die, you know, basically at their own hands. So it's also very, it talks to families who, you know, we experience that here more on a racial level than religious, but unfortunately after 9/11 everything, you see a lot of more religious intolerance as well. But we see that every day here between black and white, Hispanic and black, you know, Hispanic and white, Muslim and Christian and Jew. And it's important to remember at the end of the day, it's love that makes the world go around, not religion.
On that topic of discrimination on a plethora of bases, from gender to religion to character features, you were telling me about how there's so many different types of ethnicities in Iran that it's hard to group them all as Iranian or Persian. Could you talk about the kind of discrimination that maybe is very prevalent or isn't because of the result of so many different groups living in Iran?
Iran historically has been a mixed society. You know, started with King Cyrus, of course. He did not discriminate in any way. Didn't care what religion you followed, what ethnicity you followed. And because of that, has said 2,500 years of different religions, different ethnicities. There are probably 30-some different languages and dialects in Iran, because nobody ever said, you know what, you have to speak Persian to be Iranian. It's just not part of our culture. Discrimination in terms of ethnicity exists, not probably to the extreme that exists in the West, but the discrimination is mostly around religion, unfortunately, especially since the 1979 revolution, when there's been this religious zealousy that's taken over this country. So growing up somewhat Muslim in Iran, I lived in Tehran, which is a huge mix. It's like New York City, mix of just about everybody. When I was after fourth grade, my parents sent me to a mostly Jewish school. And it was a very eye-opening situation, because here I was living, it's kind of like living Christian or white in America. You're not exposed to the other religions as much. All of a sudden, you see all these people who are Christian, Jewish, Baha'i, but mostly Jewish, how they live in Iran. And officially, there's no discrimination against Jews, but the fact that they live in a country named the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's intimidating. It's not easy. Iran's people in general, I think, get along. I also grew up in Kurdistan. You hear a lot about Kurds and Kurdish. Same thing. It's not so much discrimination against Kurds that drives them as it is. They just feel uncomfortable living in a country. Most Kurds are Sunni, living in a country that says Shia Islam is the official religion of the country. There's also some problems with the New World Order. As public schools become popular and public universities become popular, it's hard to have different languages in a country like Iran when there's 30-some different languages. So Persian becomes the de facto language, and it's very difficult for the Kurds, there's like 30 different languages, I don't want to name every one of them. Kurds and Turks and Arabs also number very highly in Iran's population. It's difficult for them to see their children speak a different language and speak their parents' language as a second language as they grow up. Katrine's family speaks a different language, it's long name Mazandarani, but a lot of the children, grandchildren, probably have a much tougher time speaking it because in school they don't speak it and all that. So that causes some tension.
I guess on that note of talking about the types of discrimination that could happen, do you want to, I know we mentioned this before too, do you want to talk about like what some specific advice you could give to people who are thinking about traveling to Iran, like specific types of discrimination they could look out for, and yeah, just any tips, I guess, in terms of that?
Since the new president, the more extremist president, Ahmadinejad, has come to power, it's become a lot harder. Katrine came here as a refugee, and she couldn't go back for years, but under the previous president, Khatami, she was allowed to go back freely. At this point, I would be a little cautious. I would strongly recommend going with some Iranian friends who know the ins and outs. As a tourist, as a foreign tourist, you'll probably face a lot less problems in Iran than going back as an Iranian. They do get a fairly good number of tourists, especially from Europe, coming to Iran to see the ruins of Persepolis and other ancient cities. But I would just be careful, follow the rules, cover your hair if you're a woman. If you're a guy, I think you have to wear long-sleeve shirts, and I don't remember if that rule has changed or not. And there are tourists that go to Iran on a regular basis. A lot of them have ties to Iran's government, so you will face a lot less problems if you go with those tours.
And they're actually enjoying it when they go back.
Yeah, that's true. When we went back to Iran, we went to see the ruins of Persepolis, and we were probably one of the few Iranians on the site. There were Germans, Italians, a few Americans, various people all over the place.
Now, I know you guys are more of authors and we're not all foreign policy experts, but I'd like to talk about the political climate today with Iran and the tensions between Iran, the United States, Israel, and the world at large, how things are very sensitive, I think, in the minds of many people, that this is really something we hope that won't explode into, you know, the destruction of everyone. So could you guys talk about maybe how your book maybe has some good lessons or some wisdom to, I guess, revitalize the diplomacy between us two countries as well as countries all around the world on, like, a higher level, and we don't have to resort to such arrogant and, like, impulsive, I guess, discriminatory acts that are very aggressive in nature, and maybe work together to bridge the gaps between our cultures and governments?
Yeah, unfortunately, arrogance kind of goes both ways. In Iran, they call the United States, not the Iranian people, but Iran's government calls the U.S. government arrogant, vice versa. The truth is it does go both ways. What you have to remember, the 1978 revolution was more about democracy and about freedom than anything else. Iranian people rose against their government, and the big topics of that day were torture, political prisoners, having a king instead of having elected officials, corruption in government, and things like that. And it just happens that the leader of that revolution was an Ayatollah, a religious person, and the people around him did use religion as a way of pushing their own agenda. They were far more organized in the other groups, and they kind of well, practically killed all the other people after the revolution and took over. But that was I remember it. I grew up in Iran. I was there during the revolution. My parents actually took up arms and fought against the Shah for that reason. They were certainly not religious people. What they saw was a government that's a king who would not give power to the people and who was corrupt. How do we diffuse this? Well, we have 70 million people, or now probably 80 million people in Iran, who do want democracy, who do want a better country, who want a voice in their country. But unfortunately, this tension is actually killing that whole thing. It's polarizing the whole situation, where it's like, kind of like Bush says here, it's you're either with us or against us. Well, guess what? Iran's president is saying the exact same thing in Iran. He's saying you're either with us or you're against us. You're against your own country, and it's working. During the Clinton years, we had a far better chance of actually invading Iran successfully and having people of Iran work with us. Right now, it would be pretty difficult. I think what we want to do is stand down a little, give them a little breathing room, and prove to them that just like the Clinton years, just like the Reagan years, and I know you guys are not probably big fans of Reagan, but I'm a Reagan Republican myself, that we do value human rights, that it's not just lip service that we talk about. And that will go a long way in Iran, where they fought against the Shah, they overthrew him. Specifically, you know, very important part of it was political prisoners and tortures and kidnappings, and here they are under different government doing the same actions. It's kind of hard for us to talk to them and say human rights when we're kind of violating human rights here in our own country.
And I guess just take it a step back and talk more about your book. Could you talk about the process that went into this? Maybe this was a project that took years in the making, or maybe it didn't take much time at all. Yeah, would you like to talk more about your experience in this?
My wife keeps pointing to me to talk. She actually started writing this years and years ago, probably about 6 years ago. And we're not writers. I'm a software engineer by trade. And she said, "Hey, this is a really good story. It's worth telling. You know, we got to do it." And me being the skeptic, I'm like, "I don't know." Anyway, so she put a lot of time into it. She wrote big chunks of it. Then we put it on shelf for, and any author will tell you, they'll always go through the same thing. Put it on shelf, and then years later, we picked it up, wrote it again, put it back on a shelf. We started seriously writing it probably about 3 years ago in 2003. I think some of the big motivation factors were our kids. We wanted them to know the story. I think it's important for them to learn. Also, we want the American people, everybody, to hear the story. It may come from two immigrants, but it really is an American story, and hopefully an American success story more than anything else.
And I guess we've got about a minute left, so could you give some contact information? I know you said the book is now going to be published everywhere with July 10th. Could you talk more about that?
The book is already available on online stores, Amazon.com. The name is Veiled Souls. It's available also at Politics and Prose already on Connecticut Avenue in D.C. But you can go online and buy it from BarnesandNobles.com, Amazon.com, and you can visit our site, veiledsouls.com, send us comments, and ask us anything you want.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, this is WMUC-FM College Park, Seth Fresh Radio Peace. And now we're going to get into a recent live performance by the man himself, the boss, Bruce Springsteen. He was on Conan O'Brien recently. He did a song, a tribute for all the soldiers in Iraq and around the world. And we hope you enjoy.
Yes, indeed. We Shall Overcome, the Seeger Sessions, is the brand new album by my next guest. We'll be appearing this Saturday and Sunday at the PNC Bank Arts Center in Holmdel, New Jersey. Please welcome, this is a thrill, Bruce Springsteen with the Seeger Session Band.
Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. It'll make the politicians sad, I know. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. They wanna tangle with their foe. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. They wanna test the grand theories. Bring 'em home, bring 'em home. With the blood of you and me, bring them home, bring them home. We'll give no more brave young lives, bring them home, bring them home. For the gleam in someone's eye.